This is Free Speech Radio News for Monday, February 11, 2008, from KPFK in LA. I'm Aura Bogado. Hillary Clinton replaces her top advisor as Barack Obama moves closer to the Democratic nomination. Pakistan says it's captured a top Taliban commander while pre-election violence grips the land. We'll hear the latest from Islamabad. And Native Americans and their supporters walk across the country to raise awareness about the struggle to preserve sacred sites. Those stories and more, but first, these headlines.
I'm Nell Abram with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. The Pentagon announced today it will seek the death penalty for six Guantanamo Bay detainees charged with murder in the September 11th attacks. Matt Laszlo reports from Washington.
This is the first trial in connection with the September 11th attacks. The Pentagon wants to try the six men together in front of a military tribunal. Khalid Sheikh Mohammed is included in the six. The Pentagon suspects him of planning the attacks. U.S. intelligence officers coerced a confession from him through waterboarding. Brigadier General Thomas Hartman spoke on behalf of the Pentagon.
The chief prosecutor has requested that the charges be tried jointly and that they be referred as capital for each defendant. If the convening authority, Mrs. Susan Crawford, in her sole discretion, decides to refer the cases as capital, the defendants will face the possibility of being sentenced to death.
Hartman says the six men will be given the same rights as U.S. soldiers. Military tribunals conducted at Guantanamo Bay have come under scrutiny by civil liberty groups because detainees have not been allowed to see the evidence against them. The military says lawyers, journalists, and some others will be allowed inside the courtroom. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Matt Laszlo in Washington.
U.S. Defense Secretary Robert Gates said today that he now supports a pause in troop reductions in Iraq after up to 30,000 U.S. soldiers come home this summer. Gates met earlier today with General David Petraeus, who's indicated recently that he wants a period of evaluation to assess the impact on Iraq's security of reducing the U.S. military presence there. The president of East Timor is recovering in an induced coma in Australia following a failed assassination attempt. Chad Bouchard is in Jakarta.
Jose Ramos Horta was shot twice in the stomach during an early morning raid at his home. He underwent surgery in the capital city of Dili and was airlifted to Darwin in northern Australia for further treatment. Doctors said Ramos Horta was in serious condition but would likely make a full recovery. A key renegade leader, Alfredo Renado, was killed during the pre-dawn gunfight between his supporters and the president's guards. The former military police chief deserted the army in 2006 and led a revolt with hundreds of troops who were sacked by the government. The nation's prime minister, Xanana Gusmão, declared a 48-hour state of emergency and imposed a curfew after this morning's attack. Ramos Horta led a campaign against Indonesian rule, which ended with a vote for independence in 1999. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Chad Bouchard in Jakarta.
Ethiopia has agreed to host UN peacekeeping troops who have been forced to leave Eritrea. From Addis Ababa, Adro Ganotu.
Due to restrictions imposed by the Eritrean government, UN personnel have not received fuel since December. The UN set a deadline that demanded Asmara refuel the mission by last Wednesday. Eritrea ignored the call. The UN announced Friday they will remove troops from Eritrea. Today, the Ethiopian Foreign Ministry said that it has agreed to host the troops temporarily. However, it said the mission will not be operational. It will only have administrative status. At the end of January, the UN Security Council renewed the mandate of the struggling UN mission army on the border for 6 months, despite a peace deal that ended the 1998-2000 war. Ethiopia and Eritrea remained deadlocked over their 1,000-kilometer border. A UN official has said UN soldiers were reluctant to leave because they feared it could spark conflict. For Free Speech Radio News, I am Adro Gennatu in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia.
According to the Guardian of London, the U.S. is now demanding draconian levels of information on international travelers flying to, through, and even over the country. Naomi Fowler reports from London.
The European Union already supplies the US with 19 items of information on every traveller flying from the EU to the US. But now the US wants personal data on all passengers merely flying over the country, as well as those just passing through US airports. They even want data on non-travellers allowed beyond departure barriers to help elderly, young or ill passengers to board US-bound aircraft. They're also demanding armed guards on every flight. Any non-complying EU state has been threatened that it won't gain or retain visa-free travel to the US. European Union parliamentary figures have called on EU countries not to enter into bilateral agreements with the US. This is Naomi Fowler in London for Free Speech Radio News.
California Congressman Tom Lantos died this morning of esophageal cancer. He was 80 years old. Lantos was chairman of the House Committee on Foreign Affairs and one of the country's leading champions of human rights, a commitment forged when he lost nearly his entire family in the Holocaust. Lantos was the founding co-chairman of the 24-year-old Congressional Human Rights Caucus. He also founded the Congressional Friends of Animals Caucus. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Nell Abram.
A significant leap for Democratic presidential candidate Barack Obama has caused tremors in Hillary Clinton's campaign. She lost primaries and caucuses in all five states over the weekend, as Obama appears to be striding forward. Clinton has been unable to keep up with Obama's fundraising ability, and she's replaced her top advisor. This as two states and the District of Columbia vote in their primaries tomorrow, Washington editor Leanne Caldwell reports.
Obama's win by large margins in Maine, Nebraska, Louisiana, Washington, and the Virgin Islands over the weekend has propelled his march toward the party's nomination.
We won in Louisiana. We won in Nebraska. We won in Washington State. We won north, we won south, we won in between.
Obama carved out additional support in demographics that tend to vote for Hillary Clinton. White, lower class, less educated women. This defeat is Clinton's latest challenge in her candidacy that seemed inevitable just a few months ago. Over the weekend, she replaced her campaign manager, Patty Solis Doyle, with former Chief of Staff Maggie Williams. Solis Doyle will remain on staff, and Clinton says she was not forced out. But the change can be seen as an effort for fresh ideas during a challenging time. To further add to Clinton's woes, her campaign admits that Obama is likely to do well on Tuesday. They have begun focusing their attention on Texas and Ohio's March 4th primary. Despite Clinton's internal strife and Obama's added momentum, both candidates are continuing with an intense campaign schedule. In the Potomac region, Obama and Clinton volunteers are canvassing the streets, the grocery stores, and making phone calls. Advertisements have blanketed the airwaves here. On the campaign trail, Clinton is turning her attention to electability, saying she's better able to beat likely Republican nominee John McCain. Here she is in a Washington, D.C. suburb, Bowie, Maryland.
If you choose to pick a president who can be ready on day one, if you choose to pick a Democratic nominee who has been tested and vetted and can go the distance against John McCain, then I promise you, I will work my heart out for you every single day.
Obama is experiencing a huge reception in the area. About 17,000 people showed up to hear him speak at the University of Maryland. At an event in Virginia, Obama makes his case against McCain.
The strengths of this campaign has been that although I am a strong progressive, because I believe in reaching out across the aisle, because of the tone I take where I try not to demonize others, we're able to attract independents and disillusioned Republicans. And those folks have been voting in Democratic primaries and Democratic caucuses. And so that is the way you bring a working majority together. And by the way, that's the only way we're going to deliver on the policy promises that have been made.
McCain, meanwhile, had a tough weekend, but it hasn't really impacted his huge lead. Mike Huckabee beat him in Louisiana and in Kansas. McCain barely won in Washington. Huckabee is challenging that outcome. While Democrats and Republicans vote in Maryland, Virginia, and D.C. Tuesday, the Green Party contests only in the district. Central to their campaign is D.C. statehood. Former U.S. Representative Cynthia McKinney will be on the ballot, as will Ralph Nader's fill-in, Howie Hawkins. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
Pakistani authorities say they've captured a top Taliban commander and five fighters near the Afghan border today. Mullah Mansour Dabullah has led attacks against NATO and U.S.-led troops in Afghanistan. He was wounded along with five others before being captured. Pakistan's ambassador to Afghanistan, Tariq Azizuddin, is missing and feared kidnapped in the tribal region. Meanwhile, at least 25 people are dead and at least 50 more wounded after a suicide bombing Saturday at a political rally in Pakistan, also near the Afghan border. With just a week to go before the country's parliamentary elections, the violence is raising fears about increased election-related attacks. The bombing occurred just hours after police brutally battled hundreds of lawyers and civil rights activists with tear gas, batons, and rocks in one of the largest clashes of its kind in the country's capital. Zach Badarf has more from Islamabad.
About 1,500 lawyers from across Pakistan were trying to visit the home of the country's deposed Chief Justice, who's been under house arrest for more than 3 months in Islamabad. Riot police and members of the anti-terrorist squad suppressed the protests after the black-suited lawyers tried to pass a barbed wire barricade and threw stones at the police. The government forces used water cannons and then tear gas, quickly followed by baton charges. Pakistani police reported more than 30 protesters and police were injured, while 12 lawyers and activists were detained during the standoff that lasted several hours. FSRN witnessed police severely beating several elderly men and a young boy with their sticks. The police also assaulted some lawyers after being taken into custody. Fatma Wasim, a prominent Pakistani activist, said the police stopped an ambulance from taking an injured man to the hospital.
We had to shout and scream. I shouted, "You want to kill him? We will hold you responsible for this." But the police stopped the ambulance from going to the hospital. Can you believe it?
Past the barbed wire and hundreds of riot police was Chief Justice Iftikhar Chaudhry. He was sacked by Pakistan President Pervez Musharraf last November during a state of emergency. The military regime replaced the country's constitution with the Provisional Constitution Order, or PCO. Chaudhry and most of the judiciary refused to work under the PCO. Justice Manzoor Qadar, the Lahore Bar Association president, says it's clear what Chaudhry's true crime is.
He wants real democracy in the world. He wants the reinstatement of the true constitution of Pakistan. And we all want to reinstate the judiciary. These are our crimes. That is why we are punished. If the government considers this a crime, then they are right. We are guilty. We agree. Take us to jail and punish us for demanding justice. We are not afraid.
Lawyers chant, "Musharraf has the power of the bullet and the stick. He will fall, he will fall." The country's lawyers have been at the forefront of the fight to end President Musharraf's regime. Before the protests Saturday, the Pakistan Bar Council announced a total boycott of the country's entire judiciary until the elections. Munir A. Malik, the former president of the Supreme Court Bar Association, addressed the National Lawyers Convention from his home by telephone. One of nine Supreme Court justices prevented from returning to the courts, he's recovering from liver failure after possible poisoning in jail in November. The other seven Supreme Court justices have signed on to the government's demands.
The government wants to separate us and divide us, and they are trying constantly to do this. But we should not allow them to succeed. Some lawyers have been bribed, and some have been threatened. But we are not afraid, and we don't care about the bribes. We need to stand firm.
The National Law Group demanded the restoration of the legal system and deposed judges, as well as the release of detained legal figures. Speaking outside the district courts in Islamabad, Mirza Aziz Beg, the vice chairman of the Bar Association, said the American government should cooperate with the people of Pakistan, not the Musharraf regime.
There should not be any double standard. American government wants independence of judiciary in their country, but not in our country. Why?
In a speech to the assembled lawyers, sacked Supreme Court Justice Syed Zahir Ali Shah noted that President Musharraf, who retired as Chief of Army Staff in November, is still living in the Chief of Army Staff's official residence.
If Musharraf is not removed from power, the people will revolt against the government. Then a revolution will start, it will spread like fire and will cover the whole country.
The protesting lawyers scream, "Who changes Pakistan?" in Urdu. The reply, "Lawyers, lawyers." They have demanded the creation of an independent commission to check into the constitutionality of Musharraf's actions over the past few months. The All Pakistan Lawyers Convention will hold their next rally in Lahore in mid-March. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Zach Badorf in Islamabad.
Human rights groups say that after 1 year in power, Ecuador's president Rafael Correa is making some important strides, coupled with some worrisome trends. The annual report from Quito's Regional Human Rights Advisory Foundation says that while Correa is strong on social investment in matters such as education, health, and housing, his government continues to repress and criminalize those accused of being involved in conflicts related to mining and oil production. But a new proposal before the National Constituent Assembly demands amnesty for hundreds of people that are currently wrapped up in a criminal process for fighting against the exploitation of the land and the environment. Jennifer Moore has more from Quito, Ecuador.
The list, presented to the National Constituent Assembly last week, includes roughly 250 names of people facing criminal charges for their opposition to extractive industries such as oil production and metallic mining exploration. Charges include allegations of kidnapping, robbery, and terrorism and sabotage, amongst others. Several human rights organizations and coalitions representing affected communities spent 6 months compiling the list and drafting a proposal for amnesty. Jose Serango, assembly member from the indigenous Pachakutik movement, presented the proposal. Salvador Quispe, a former Congress member, is his current advisor.
It's angering, really, how the government applies justice for some that it believes should be spared and pursuing others who aren't its allies.
During his annual report to the nation several weeks ago, President Rafael Correa's request for amnesty included past President Gustavo Noboa, amongst others. Rodrigo Aucay is president of the Committee in Defense of Nature and Life from the Southern Amazonian region. Aucay has 26 charges against him for a wide variety of allegations, including kidnapping. Many involved in the amnesty movement support his innocence. Daily life is difficult for him and his family, given the alleged threats from groups he says are believed to be receiving money from transnational mining corporations.
There's been the risk that with so many charges that the public prosecutor could file an order for my imprisonment. Just imagine how that would affect my family, apart from the ton of threats that we already deal with.
Between 2006 and 2007, the Regional Human Rights Advisory Foundation observed that at least 60 leaders like Aucay from indigenous and campesino communities have been criminalized for defending human rights and the environment. The majority of charges or complaints against them have been laid by people employed by or otherwise linked to national or transnational extractive industry companies, leading the human rights group to conclude that the companies view such leaders as obstacles to realizing their projects. For Aucay, living along the southern border of Ecuador with Peru, there's an irony in the way he and others opposed to mining have been treated by the government, and recalls how Ecuadorians defending their country were regarded during earlier conflicts with Peru.
Whether military or not, Ecuadorians who were defending their country were decorated. Now those of us defending the country are charged or put in jail. It's become a crime to defend the lives of our children and of future generations. Charging us has given transnational corporations a tool to use against us. We have demonstrated this and we're asking for amnesty.
Salvador Quispe has also seen several conflicts up close. In 2006, he was at a protest against local mining exploration in his home province of Zamora Chinchipe. The armed forces broke up the protest, and Quispe says violently detained him and others. The occurrence was reported to the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights in March 2007 and is one of several examples in which the armed forces or national police have used excess force against unarmed protests. Quispe resents how, paradoxically, their struggle is often represented as violent.
We are not violent. We are people that have been struggling for decades demanding respect for our cultures, for our lands, and for our water.
While the majority of natural resource concessions were granted under previous governments, the Regional Human Rights Advisory Foundation says the Correa regime needs to take responsibility. They suggest implementing strong public policies to decriminalize dissent and to ensure strong public participation in decisions over extractive projects. If not, they conclude, Ecuador can anticipate many more conflicts in defense of nature, water, and sustainable development in the years to come. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Jennifer Moore in Quito, Ecuador.
Native American activists and their supporters began the longest walk to today from Alcatraz Island to Washington, D.C., trekking across the country to raise awareness about global warming and the movement to protect sacred sites. The five-month-long coast-to-coast journey commemorates the 30-year anniversary of the original longest walk in 1978. Christina Honestad has more.
Native youth and elders will be walking through Midwest winters with snow and below zero weather, 15 miles a day for the next 5 months. While elders are putting effort into the longest walk too, most of the walkers are Native youth. They descended upon Alcatraz Island to kick off the longest walk too.
I'm a descendant of Cortina Rancheria, Wintun. Our tribe is about 103 members. They're putting in a massive landfill to put trash over our sacred sites. We have 7 people that live on the reservation. Our elders that live on the reservation are totally against the destruction of our land.
A lot of gang violence upon the youth and a lot of drug addictions, you know, within the families. I want to walk for the healing of our people, the healing of our younger generations, and start standing up.
Our generation has lost the connection to spirituality, and we're beginning now to find it again.
Native Americans with AIM, the American Indian Movement, organized the first longest walk in 1978 to bring attention to the U.S. government's attempt to chip away at tribal sovereignty. It was the same year Native youth occupied Alcatraz, a prison that once held Native Americans for refusing to send their children to boarding schools that taught only white ways, forced assimilation. Faye Roman, a Choctaw from Oklahoma, went on the longest walk in 1978 with her 3 young sons. She says at the time there were 11 bills pending before Congress that would have eroded what sovereignty her people had.
The bills that were in Congress that year wanted to take away the Indian rights. And when we say Indian, we want to stress that they wanted to take away the reservations. They wanted to phase out the reservations. They wanted to phase out some of the treaties that the United States had signed with the Native Nations. And it would have totally caused chaos. They would have taken away funding for Indian education. They would have taken away land and water rights.
For many, the struggle continues. Since the 1970s, the Western Shoshone have opposed the U.S. government's use of sacred land to test nuclear weapons and store nuclear waste. They've also opposed gold mining there. Since the 1960s, the University of California, Berkeley, has withheld over 12,000 Native American skeletal remains from Native tribes fighting to reclaim them. Lupita Torres is a student at DQ University, one of the nation's oldest Native American colleges. She says the issues facing Native communities 30 years ago are the same today.
The same issues that were affecting our communities about 30 years ago are still the same issues that are affecting us now. With the power plants, the uranium mining, the coal mining, the nuclear power plants, the coal power plants, most of the pollution comes from those coal power plants. And the nuclear power plants are not clean. There's a lot of toxic waste you have to dump, and all those things, they're residing on the Indian reservations. And it's causing things like asthma, diabetes, mercury in the air.
That's why Native Americans are again walking nearly 8,000 miles from California to Washington, D.C. This time, they'll be taking 2 routes. The second longest walk will culminate in Washington, D.C. this summer, where activists will draft an indigenous declaration calling for the protection of sacred sites and Mother Earth. From DQ University and Alcatraz Island, I'm Christina Honestad for Free Speech Radio News.
The payday loan industry has exploded across the country, generating billions of dollars each year by offering fast and easy short-term loans with sky-high interest rates. In Virginia, where payday loan companies can legally charge up to 782% APR on a cash advance loan, a coalition of grassroots groups has been fighting for several years to put limits on the payday loan industry, and this year they're making progress. several bills that would place restrictions on the industry, including the number of loans a person can take out each year, are currently making their way through the state legislature. From Richmond, FSRN's Catherine Comp reports.
On this busy intersection in Southside Richmond, there are four payday lending stores within plain view. All are open 6 days a week, and one, Check City, has a drive-through for regular customers. If a person needed to, they could walk from store to store, paying off debt from Check City by using a loan from Payday USA or Ace Cash Express. Jay Spear is executive director of the Virginia Poverty Law Center. He says that payday loan stores were designed to put people into a cycle of debt.
You'll hear the payday lenders talk about how, yes, some people use our product irresponsibly and that kind of stuff, but that's really total nonsense, because when you get into this cycle of repeat loaning, that is exactly what you're supposed to do. You have to ask yourself, why do you have to pay the whole loan back on your next paycheck or Social Security on your next Social Security check? Well, it's that way on purpose so that you really can't pay it back without having to get another loan immediately to pay your rent and your utilities.
Virginia's 2002 Payday Loan Act was a boon to the industry, permitting the licensing of such companies and exempting them from a previous 36% interest rate. Over the last 5 years, 800 such stores have opened across the state. Stores generally charge $15 per every $100 borrowed, with a $500 cap on each loan. The loan period ranges from 7 to 30 days, depending on how often a person gets paid. Speaking before a state Senate committee meeting, legal aid attorney John Whitfield said his clients in the small city of Harrisonburg are the working poor and people on Social Security, people without much of a chance to pay off the interest.
One client that just came in that we have right now is Ruby. She's an elderly woman from Shenandoah County. Her husband died. She was on Social Security. She took out a payday loan, $500, interest $75. Each month, she'll take her Social Security check in of $600 and some, cash it, pay them another $75. She had done that for 18 months up through December. So on that $500 loan, Ruby has paid over $2,000, and she still owes the same amount she borrowed.
In 2007, Virginians took out an estimated 3.5 million payday loans, according to payday lending spokesperson Reggie Jones. He represents an industry advocacy group called Community Financial Services Association. After successfully stopping bills to limit payday lending in past sessions, Jones now admits that some of these borrowers are getting stuck in the debt trap.
We do support more serious reform, and the reason we do, if you look at statistics at the State Corporation Commission, about 20% of the borrowers, we believe, use this product in a way that is not for short-term credit. And we want to deal with that issue. That is a risky borrow for the industry, and that's not what this product is intended for.
A House committee has approved a bill that would cap loans at 36%, increase the loan cycle to 2 pay periods, limit loans to 5 per year, and establish an industry-wide database of borrowers. Delegate Ken Melvin from southeastern Virginia said he'll support the bill, but urged his colleagues to look at the bigger problem of poverty in the state.
Is it surprising that people need money? It's not. And if you can get it this easy, they're going to get it. We have a responsibility to protect the people of Virginia.
The state Senate is meeting in a closed-door session Monday to work out their version of the bill. In Richmond, I'm Catherine Comp for Free Speech Radio News.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. From KPFK in LA, I'm Aura Bogado.